To paraphrase the great Austin Powers, Jeff Merrick.
Who
throws a sausage sandwich, honestly?
Someone, I don't know, trying to assist or thwart Tyler Sagan would now be the answer.
Now, you say that, sir, but the sausage sandwich in Chicago that we're speaking of clearly landed behind Johan Hedberg. I say that it was Johan Hedberg who was the target of the sausage sandwich sabotage in Boston last night.
The old slip on the sausage trick in the shootout. Yeah, that's right out of the playbook. Right out of the playbook. Sure wish. You know, I've said this before on the podcast. Hang on. I've said this before on the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the job you have today is the job you have every day. And your job as a human being every day is try to stay alive. And one of the reasons why you try to stay alive is if you do, I guarantee you, more times than not, you're going to see some really funny shit. It's just going to happen. Things you just don't expect to happen. Like, who woke up yesterday saying, you know what? I bet today, I'm going to see Tyler Sagan in a shootout and someone's going to throw a sausage in a bun. Either at him or Johan Hedberg.
Well, when hands you put up it that way.
Hands up, who said that around the podcast here today? Just stay alive, folks. I'm serious. Your job is to stay alive. That's job number one.
Yes. As the great Daniel Day-Lewis said in Last of the Mohegans, "Stay alive, no matter what occurs. I will find you." The greatest thing about the sausage tossing story last night. There's two great things. First of all, it's the fact that immediately, the good people of Boston started to do the thing like the Vancouver people did during the riots, which is to try to turn narc and try to sniff out who this person was, this nefarious sausage tosser, who this person was that was besmirching the good name of Bostonian fans. And there's a video on Puck Daddy, that does seem to indicate that they've maybe identified who it is, and somebody on the HF boards came forward and said, yeah, it was somebody in my section. So maybe we'll find out who this aerial meat-throwing perpetrator is. But the second best thing about the Beantown sausage bomber incident, as I've termed it, is the fact that we have now discovered something new about the shootout. Raise your hands. I will put the quiz right back to the audience, Jeff Merrick. Raise your hands if you knew what happens when someone throws a sausage sandwich during a shootout attempt. Anybody?
You know, I what I do is, you know, wish before every season I reread the rule book just to acquaint myself and refresh myself with the rules of the game. I don't remember anything in there about thrown sausages on the ice. I'm going to have to go back and look at it again, but I'm not sure what the penalty is for thrown sausages on the ice.
Well, the actual rule is in rule 24.4, as we all know. And it says, remember, the rules of the shootout are actually the rules of the penalty shot. If while the penalty shot is being taken, a spectator throws any object on the ice or, in the judgment of the referee, interferes with the player taking the shot or the goalkeeper defending the shot, he shall permit the shot to be taken again. Which means, whether you're throwing a sausage sandwich on the ice behind Johan Hedberg or you're blinding somebody with a laser pointer, this shot will be taken again if you're a spectator monkeying around with a legitimate skills competition attempt.
Let me ask you another question. Let me go another step or another layer to the sausage dilemma, or as you called it, what did you call it? Sausage Gate? No, what did you call it?
I called it the Beantown Sausage Bomber Incident.
Right. The Beantown Sausage Bomber Incident. Okay, so we know now what happens if a fan throws something onto the ice, be it a sausage or what have you.
Jeff Merrick, of course, more in favor of somebody throwing a rutabaga or an eggplant on the ice versus a full sausage sandwich, a nice portobello mushroom sandwich.
Portobello mushrooms, yeah, maybe a nice chunk of tempeh would be nice just to chuck there on the ice.
The city of Anchorage, Arizona.
Well, that's tempeh. Kinda heavy. Jeez, I'm going to explain to you about being curd. Here's my question about the shoot, and I've always wondered this, Wish. You can probably answer it for me. Mm-hmm. What happens if a goalie commits a penalty on a penalty shot? Like, let's say Tyler Sagan is coming in and Johan Hedberg decides, you know what, I've had a bad day. The kids are on me all day. My wife won't stop nagging me. Blah, blah, blah. I've had a horrible day. Coach won't play me. It's my first start of the year. Marty gets all the games. And he decides to take it out on Tyler Seguin. Seguin comes in and he cross-checks him in the face, or he slashes him across the knee. What's the call? What's the penalty?
Two things. First of all, you invoking the name of Marty Brodeur made me think that perhaps the fan did believe Marty Brodeur was the goaltender and hence would jump up and grab the sandwich
right,
through his mask.
Right, distraction.
The other thing is, you bring up a penalty. You know, there was a moment last night in the shootout between the Bruins and Devils when Tuukka Rask went out to, quote-unquote, make a save, I believe, on Travis Zajac was the shooter. I think it was Zajac was the guy. And like what most goalies, quote-unquote, lunge to make a save, it was pretty much just to take the guy's skates out. It had nothing to do with the puck. You're just trying to take the guy's skates out. Of course, no penalty. If there is a penalty in a shootout, I happen to know this because, as you know, I'm an aficionado of the shootout. It's my favorite thing in hockey.
You love it.
If Johan Hedberg had skated out and kabonged Tyler Seguin with his goalie stick, much like Captain Caveman would have back in an old Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Captain Caveman.
Here's what happens. Rule 24-4 covers this as well. When an infraction worthy of a minor penalty is committed by the goaltender during the penalty shot that causes the shot to fail, no penalty is to be assessed, but the referee shall permit the shot to be taken over again. So in other words...
Wait a minute.
What?
So all it is a do-over?
It's a do-over.
So... guy can come in, you can wound him, and all that happens is he goes back to the dot.
It gets when a major or match penalty is committed by the goalkeeper that causes the shot to fail, the referee shall permit the shot to be taken over again, and the appropriate penalty shall be assessed to the goalkeeper. Now, that's for a major. So, an injury of some sort, like a kabonging or a spearing or a slash to the ankle that shatters the ankle, then I imagine there's some serious infraction. But if you're a goaltender who trips a guy, hooks a guy, runs up and bear hugs a guy, not letting him get a shot off, let's say, well, then all you do is reshoot, which to me is the hockey equivalent of a team in football stepping offside or encroaching just to see what the play is going to be that the offense was running. Or even better yet, like calling a timeout right before the team runs an offensive play. You're getting a glimpse of what the shooter is going to do, and then you shoot it again.
I'll disagree with you on that, because if you look at what Tyler Seguin did yesterday, the first goal that he scored, we'll call it the sausage goal. The sausage goal, he used a forehand move. He shot on his forehand. But if you look at the non-sausage goal,
known as the onions and peppers goal, by the way. The onions and peppers goal.
But if you look at the second goal, Wish, it's a backhand move.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if Moose said, aha, I know what he's going to do. He's going to drop shoulder, kick his leg, and then fake and go forehand. Not a chance. Tyler Seguin went backhand on that. You know, and when you really think about it, that is one of the most remarkable things that we've seen in the shootout. I know that, you know, Merrick Malik gets a lot of to-dos about the Statue of Liberty between the legs goal and the Statue of Liberty celebration. Pavel Datsyuk has made goaltenders look silly for a number of years, Linus Omark as well. But back-to-back shootout goals with two different moves, it's kind of crazy, man. That's one of the best shootout things we've ever seen.
Now, here's the thing, though, about goalies and penalties in the shootout that you may not know. Yes, if a minor penalty is committed by a goaltender during the penalty shot, the shooter gets another chance at it. Should a goalkeeper commit a second such violation during the penalty shot, same shot, and the shot fails, what do you think happens? What fate befalls a goalkeeper who would dare commit two minor penalties during the same penalty shot, Jeff Merrick?
Does he get removed?
Well, he gets assessed a misconduct penalty. And the referee shall permit the penalty shot to be taken over. The NHL rulebook says nothing along the lines of the goaltender being removed, just that he has a misconduct penalty. And one assumes that, much like during the normal course of a game, if a goaltender receives a misconduct penalty, then simply a player from the bench would serve that penalty. Yes?
I don't like it.
Now, hold on. What if something...
I don't like it one bit.
What if something really crazy happens? What if a goaltender commits a minor penalty. Then on the next attempt, he commits yet another minor penalty. And then on the third attempt, this goaltender, nefarious rule breaker that he is, the bastard love child of Ron Hextall and Billy Smith that he is, let's say this goaltender commits a third minor penalty during same shootout attempt.
And let's just call him, for sake of argument, I don't know, Robin Lehner. Continue, Wish.
Let's say that Robin Lehner commits a third penalty in the course of the same penalty shot attempt. What do you think happens then?
Game misconduct.
Yes. Then the goalkeeper, three strikes and you're out, shall be assessed a game misconduct penalty. And yet again, the shooter takes another shot. So at no point during this this minor penalty malarkey is the goal simply just awarded, right? So here's the thing. Like, there are certain rules of decorum that I think that keep the NHL and hockey itself from spiraling off its own axis into a thunderdome of lawless behavior, blood, violence, and criminality. And in the shootout, the same thing applies. If a goaltender wanted to, a goaltender could commit a minor penalty twice on every shootout attempt.
Yeah.
And all that would happen is a player from the bench would have to go to the box. Like, the last guy in the shootout lineup would have to go to the box, and the shooter would get another chance to shoot the puck on goal.
So the question then becomes, why doesn't it happen more often?
Because there are rules of decorum that keep the NHL from spiraling off its axis into a realm of lawlessness, violence, and criminality, Jeff Merrick. Thank God that the goaltenders in this league have the good sense not to bend the rules as they are currently written, because, as we've just stated, they totally could.
I can't wait until Robin Lehner takes the crease away from Craig Anderson in Ottawa. Because if anyone is going to test this rule, it is going to be that goaltender. What'd you call him? Love child of Ron Hextall and Billy Smith?
Yes.
If there's anyone that's going to be that, I'm saying it's Robin Lehner. Here's what I think should happen, Wish. How about this for an idea? We make it pretty simple. As opposed to just, well, there's certain rules of decorum that everybody understands, and the goaltenders are on the honor system. They wouldn't do anything untowards a player who's coming down to shoot on them in an almost no-win situation. Here's what I think should happen. If a goaltender commits an offense on a penalty shot, whether it's a trip, whether it's a spear, whether it's whatever it is, it's an automatic goal. It's an automatic goal. Because this isn't a quote-unquote traditional hockey play. This is a slice of a game. Something that does, by the way, already exists within the rules. It's called the penalty shot. But everything else is stripped away from it, and it's just one-on-one. There is no reason other than that singular advantage to do anything untowards, to commit a foul. How about this? It's kind of like throwing your stick, right? It's kind of like hand on the puck in the crease. Goalie commits a foul. It's an automatic goal. Wouldn't that just take all of this away? Wouldn't this remove everything? Just make it easier, Wish.
I want to remove the shootout. Is that possible?
Well, I know you want to remove the shootout, but I'm sorry it's here to stay.
Don't tell me that. That's depressing. All right, so there you go. A little shootout education sparked, as many great conversations about this game are, by a flying sausage aimed at a goaltender. Boston, never change, baby. With that, we shall start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Are you familiar with the game called hockey?
All I have to do is talk for a living.
If you say lube 10 times, you just feel better.
You say lube 10 times, you gotta feel better.
Why shouldn't I always be happy? I'm stealing money.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I went through life with this last name, okay? I'm a kindly old wizard. Close your eyes, hold your nose, swallow the medicine.
Debate hockey.
Swift Current Broncos. Lethbridge Hurricanes. The Vancouver Giants.
God.
Pop culture.
I don't want to be culturally insensitive. I never am on this show, so we still may have Twinkies here in the States.
Still may have the ho-ho. Good news,
might have the ding-dong.
And more hockey.
Jeff Merrick on the puck.
Up and down.
Knocking the biscuit around.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Let's start the show proper, shall we?
Coming down the pike as we start the show today, Jeff Merrick, Colin McDonald, who, a player that, frankly, I've never heard of until today. Colin McDonald of the New York Islanders suspended 2 games for a hit from behind on Ben Lovejoy of the Pittsburgh Penguins in their game last night. I thought 3. Going back to seeing the suspensions from last season, sir, I thought 3 for this hit. Maybe 2 because Lovejoy wasn't injured as far as we know. He came back, played in the third period. As far as boarding penalties and as far as the stuff that the venerable Department of Player Safety, you can follow it, by the way, at NHL Player Safety on Twitter.
That's right.
It's the kind of hit that they legislate out of this game. It was such a worthless play on behalf of McDonald with Lovejoy. A shove from behind didn't need to make, and then kind of leaving his skates to drive him into the glass. I guess 2 games is fine. I thought maybe 3.
Yeah, but again, I've given up guessing on penalties. I think I decided to stop sometime around mid last year trying to throw darts at penalties. I just said, well.
You mean on for suspensions?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, suspensions rather.
Yeah.
I just kind of quit because I don't know. And listen, it's a hard gig and there's so much gray area. I'm just looking at the video now, as the video will show.
You want to turn up the audio so people can hear at home?
Yeah, you want to do it here? Hang on.
Yeah, please. Beginning.
Hold on.
Well,
hold
you don't
on.
Have to start from the beginning. We could just pick it up in the middle of it.
Hang on. Let me just turn my microphone around.
It was, by the way, it was 4-0 Islanders at this point.
New York Islanders forward Colin McDonald was
can you hear
assessed
that?
A major penalty yeah. reporting Pittsburgh Penguins defenseman Ben Lovejoy.
Ben Lovejoy.
As the video shows.
Love that line.
Pursues it.
Oh.
By the time he reaches the face-off dot, he is directly behind Lovejoy. He continues on his path, all the while looking at Lovejoy's numbers.
He does.
Recklessly drives the Pittsburgh defender into the boards with great force.
Recklessly hitting the numbers.
A boarding penalty is defined as checking or pushing a defenseless opponent in such a manner that causes the opponent to hit or impact the boards violently.
Uh-huh.
The key factors for us elevating this penalty to a suspension are a combination of the length of time that McDonald sees Lovejoy's numbers,
uh-huh.
the degree and force with which McDonald hits right through his opponent. What's also significant in our decision is that Lovejoy does not turn his back just prior to or simultaneous with the contact.
Unlike Pat Coletta.
Thank you.
Is that what you're waiting for?
I was waiting for that.
While we accept McDonald's assertion that there was no malicious intent on this hit, it still remains a reckless and dangerous play. To summarize, this was boring.
Yeah, to summarize. McDonald will forfeit $7,567 for this 2-game suspension, sir.
Mm-hmm. First of all, how can you do something... How can you do something like that to someone named Lovejoy? How dare you?
I know, right?
You should walking up.
You know, I think trying to do that. You're absolutely right. Like if you were ever looking for a player that personifies the Brian Burke give the guy a bear hug rule, it'd be a dude named Lovejoy.
Lovejoy.
You just want to run up and give that guy some snuggles.
Like, you don't walk up and slap the Dalai Lama. Like, come on. Who hits Lovejoy from behind? Come on, man. Have a heart. Come on, McDonald. You don't do that to a dude like that. You know what, though? And again, sure, it's a penalty, and I get that, and I understand why. And blah, blah, new rules, and I got to grow up, and I got to learn the game again. Blah, 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 blah. But we see that play. We see that play every game, Wish. But the thing is, Lovejoy was bent over, and he stayed bent over. And that's why his head went in. A lot of guys would just straighten their legs at that point and just go in and take the hit. Like, honestly, watch. There's only 4 games tonight. But if you want... Watch when players chase the puck into the corner when there's a hate to get all coachy on you. The F1 who's in there, the first forechecker, when he goes in after him, if he's close, he's not going to go in leaning over his hips and he's not going to go in his knees bent. He's going to go in a little more straight because he knows a body check is coming. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is, yes, it was reckless by McDonald, but it was also reckless as well of Lovejoy to put himself in that situation, specifically when he knows that McDonald is behind him, because at the faceoff dot, McDonald has his hand on his back. He knows there's someone coming right there. Like in that moment, you straighten up and you prepare to take the hit. Like did you see Ben Lovejoy in that scenario in any way, shape, or form, Wish, prepare himself to take a hit? Not at all.
No.
He doesn't prepare himself at all to take a hit. I understand why it's a penalty. I know what you're going to go, oh, Jeff.
You're differentiating between what should be a penalty and what should be a suspension, is what you're saying. Not every penalty is a suspension.
I don't even necessarily know that in my world that should be a suspension. See, I see wrong with McDonald because he is bent over, vulnerable position, and you really put the guy in harm's way. But as well, I also see Ben Lovejoy. If I'm his coach, I'm saying to him out there, man, you gotta be smarter than that going into the boards. You can't bend over going into the boards like that when you know there's someone trailing you. You can't assume they are just going to let up because this is a contact game. And 9 times out of 10, again, a player like McDonald, if he doesn't finish his check, he's nailed to the bench. I'm just saying there's onus both ways.
Yeah, I know. I get the nail to the bench thing. It's your go-to argument for why guys should make hits that shouldn't be in the league. But here's the point. The point is that the Department of Player Safety and the NHL has made it a mandate where they want to allow players to make these plays without worrying about getting their head implanted into the glass. So whilst it could be a good hockey play in the past, Rafi Torres / Jeff Merrick, now it is something that deserves a suspension. And that is what these players have to learn, is that even
though the guy's
back is to you and you're trying to separate him from the puck, you cannot take your hands and your arms and drive him into the boards when his numbers are facing you. Are we so close, Jeff Merrick, to putting stop signs on the backs of these sweaters?
That doesn't work.
So guys Colin McDonald understand you can't make the play anymore.
We got to get to our guest here, but that doesn't, by the way, work anymore in minor hockey. No, everyone looks at the stop signs, and it just becomes like a part of the number or the nameplate. No one really cares anymore. But I do say, watch hockey tonight. How many times will you see that play? And countless times, the defenseman will straighten up and prepare himself to take the hit. Lovejoy didn't prepare himself to take the hit. Not saying that he got what he deserved. I'm just saying is you have to take responsibility for yourself out there as well. We have Ken Campbell aboard. I've been waiting to talk to Ken for quite some time. I got this book a while ago. It's called Selling the Dream, How Hockey Parents and Their Kids Are Paying the Price for Our National Obsession. Ken Campbell of the Hockey News joins us now. How are you today, Ken?
I'm well, Mr. Merrick. I haven't spoken to you in quite some time. And you, Mr. Wyszynski, how are you?
Hi, Ken. How are you? Now, you're right for the hockey news. You're a bleeding heart. Don't you think we should get hits like the Colin McDonald hit out of the game for the sake of these players' safety?
Of course we should. Of course. Absolutely. I mean, I've been railing against that kind of stuff for years now.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, do you think there is a responsibility for a player like Ben Lovejoy to recognize the oncoming forechecker and not put himself in a vulnerable position?
Right. Yes, there is some responsibility there, but I think there's also a responsibility on the guy hitting too. And he's got to know when to let up. And you know what? These guys know. They know when a guy's in a vulnerable position. They know everything. And if they choose not to heed that, then woe be them.
I want to talk about a couple of things with you. Woe be them. I want to talk about Markham. I want to talk about Phoenix. I think we both do here, Ken, me and Greg. But first, this is a fascinating book, dude. And I've been waiting for someone to write this for quite a long time, specifically in Canada, where you're right. Hockey is a religion. Hockey is a cult. Hockey turns parents, and I'm sure I'm going to be one day, even though my oldest is only 2.5 going on 3, into walking ATM machines. How long have you wanted to write this book, Ken?
It's been sort of rattling around my brain for quite some time. And I really started to see it when I went to like things like the NHL draft. I remember a couple of years ago when Zach Bogosian was drafted in the first round, I talked to him and like he lived in Messina, New York, and every day in the summer he would drive to Ottawa to go work with Lauren Goldenberg, one of the big time strength and conditioning coaches. He'd drive all over the place to play summer hockey in Montreal and Ottawa and then drive back to Messina, New York every night. And he'd do that all summer. And I just started thinking about all of the sacrifices that people are making and parents are making. And you know what? In the case of Zach Bogosian, hey, a great investment worked out. You know, Matt Duchene's parents spent $300,000 on his minor hockey career. Hey, that, you know, I mean, Matt Duchene could make $20, $30, $40 million by the end of it. So that's a great investment. But I think we all know for every Matt Duchene and Zach Bogosian, there are a laundry list of guys who don't make it and sort of what happens to them. And, you know, do we sort of need to dial things down here a little bit, particularly at the really young ages? And you know, I mean, 2.5, Jeff, your kid's 2.5, 3 years old. It's never too early, my friend. you better get him going. Like if he doesn't start pretty soon, he's going to get left behind. And then next thing you know, your NHL dream is going to be a pipe dream, buddy. So you better get on that.
Well, Kenny, he is draft class 2028. Not that I measured that the minute he came out of his mother, but nonetheless.
Yeah, did you plan properly? Like, did you plan to have him in the first 3 months of the year? You know,
June. I just missed it.
The first thing. I remember when my son was born. My first son was born January 9th, and I was telling Paul Henry, who used to be a long time scout in the NHL. He says,
"Tell him
about my son." He says, "Oh yeah,
which is
birthday, January 9th. Great hockey birthday." He says,
"Yeah." Well, you know, with TJ, I got it wrong. He's a June, but our second kid, guys, is a January 17th. So the second time, I got it right.
Oh, that's a great hockey birthday. He's already probably got an enormous leg up on probably like almost everybody now. So like really, like you should really start putting money aside, and then it'll all pay off for you, Jeff, because your kid's gonna be in the NHL. You know that, right?
Well, of course.
That's the thing here. Your kid, we know that nobody makes it. We know that it's the odds are astronomically infinitesimal. But you know what? That doesn't matter because your kid's gonna be the one to do it.
Yeah, well, my daughter was born during the Flyers rally against the Bruins in the playoffs a couple years back. I don't plan. It wasn't very good planning to have my daughter born during the Stanley Cup playoffs at all. It was stupid planning.
Hey,
Ken, so again, the book is selling the dream. I wanted to ask you specifically from this book about the rise of people like you write, taking advantage of families and kids. You know, there's an entire like side business now in hockey where you've got all these like charlatans coming up and they know that parents are desperate to make their kid better, to drink the magic elixir and make the kid better. What are some of the things that you think hockey parents have to be wary of out there?
Well, I've been saying this for a long time is, not all of these guys are charlatans. I mean, you know, there's a guy by the name of Yari Burski in Toronto who's one of the best skill coaches you'll ever find. I mean, and you look at the guys he's worked with, you could put together an NHL All-Star team with the kids that he's worked with. He's worked with, you know, Stamkos and Wojtek Wolski and Michael Delzato and, you know, I mean, you name it, a good player who's come out of Toronto in the last 10 years. And this guy's probably worked with them. So, I mean, they're not all charlatans, but they are selling a dream. Like, that's what they're doing. I mean, they are selling the fact that if you go with this with me and you pay the money and you put in the time and the effort, the chances of your son, being an elite hockey player are going to, they're going to grow. And it's true because they do. But I mean, what about the kids that don't have the resources for that? And so it really, to me, it really creates a really super elite system. But the thing that I always caution parents with is I think that what you really have to watch out for and one of the places where the rubber really hits the road is when parents start to look at their child's participation in sports as an investment. Mm-hmm. And they start saying things like, well, you know, as long as he gets like a scholarship, like those, like they're giving those out, like, you know, out of Pez dispensers these days, right? You know, I mean, if he can only get a scholarship, then, you know, all of this is going to all be worthwhile. Well, no, it's not really. But I mean, if that's what you want to say, tell yourself, that's great. But I think that's where it really gets dangerous is when parents start to expect some sort of payback on this quote unquote investment they're making in minor hockey. And it is a huge, as you guys know, it's a huge amount of money that we're talking about here. If you want your son or daughter to play top elite level hockey in most places in Canada, you're looking at probably at least like bare minimum $10,000 a year and a couple of thousand more if your son's a goalie. So it's a huge amount of money.
Ken, I want to get to Mitchell Davis and that example in a second, but you mentioned Matthew Shane off the top, and that's the one chapter in your book, Selling the Dream, that I think a lot of people can relate to because they all know Matt Shane, and so you can sort of understand what it took from his parents to go from the root to the fruit, and here he is in the NHL, and he's got a $3.5 million contract, but can you outline some of the sacrifices his parents had to make, nice family from Halliburton, had to make in order to get Matt Shane into the NHL?
Well, basically, his dad and mom, they both had good jobs. His dad sold, Halliburton, Jeff, you probably know this, but a lot of people don't. Halliburton is like a cottager's paradise, just north of Toronto. And his dad sold, was a real estate guy, so he would primarily sell cottages and properties, in that area. And his mom was a teacher at the high school. Well, they moved into their first house. It was a little starter home, and they figured they'd be there for 5 years, and then they'd move on. Well, 19 years later, they were still in that little starter's home. And he was telling me that there was virtually no time during the time that Matt was playing that their credit line wasn't maxed out and their credit card, they were maxed out on their credit cards, maxed out on their credit line, and they virtually had like no money to spend. And his dad would tell me that, you know, a lot of, like one of the big things that's really cropped up is spring hockey now, and a lot of the best kids now are playing spring hockey, and they form these kind of super teams, you know, of guys from all over a province, and they go in these spring tournaments. Well, Duchesne was doing that, and he was going in these tournaments. Well, the problem was there was that this guy's, that's like prime time to sell cottages, right? That's when people want to buy cottages for the next summer. So he was having to give up, thousands and thousands of dollars of potential, earnings. Because he was away at these tournaments on weekends instead of showing cottages to people up in Halliburton. So it was an enormous sacrifice for the both of them, an enormous investment. And that's what it is. I mean, that's what it can be for a lot of families, that, you know, and not just a financial sacrifice. It's often, you know, family sacrifices. It's often, you know, social development sacrifices. What you don't understand about these guys that go to the NHL is, you know, they don't go to the high school dance. They don't get to be a kid in a lot of ways. You know, they grow up so quickly and they're so immersed and everything is so regimented for them that, you know, they don't get to do that stuff. They don't get to go off to university and find themselves or travel around and, you know, backpack and all that sort of stuff. So it's an enormous sacrifice, and that family made just incredible sacrifices for Matt Duchesne. As I said, hey, good investment, you know, great investment. It's going to pay off 20-fold or maybe 50-fold, but there's a lot of people who are doing the same thing that, you know, when it comes down to it, the game doesn't owe anybody anything. And I think that's one thing people have to realize is hockey doesn't owe anyone anything. Just because you put in all this work and spent all this money and you played by the rules and you worked your ass off doesn't mean you're going to get an NHL career. And I think a lot of people have to realize that, you know, that there's a very good chance, and in fact, it's an incredibly good chance that there won't be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Hey, I wanted to talk to you about this Markham Arena. You've been on that story for a really long time, the new arena that may or may not be built in the Greater Toronto area and the NHL team that may or may not be there. What were your thoughts about the developments last night and the notion that, according to Paul Kelly, the NHL has been looking to expand to Toronto since he was running the NHLPA?
Yeah, he's expressed that to me before that they've been looking at Toronto and Quebec City. And I mean, I wasn't at the meeting last night, unfortunately, because I'm in Montreal. I was at the Jets Canadians game last night. I had already committed to doing a cover story on Evander Kane. So I wasn't at that meeting last night, and I'm glad I wasn't there because it went 8 hours. I've been pretty well on top of things here, and I was pretty sure that it was going to pass by the skin of its teeth, which is exactly what happened. And they also passed they also accepted the site plan, which means basically they can start getting shovels on the ground now, which is huge for these guys and sort of get things going. So I just think that Toronto is the most underserviced hockey market in the world. It just is. I mean, it could handle two teams quite easily. And I think it's only a matter of time before it happens. I mean, there's just too much money there and too much revenue potential there for the NHL to continue to ignore it. And I think within the next couple of years, it's going to happen. It'll happen in Toronto, and it'll happen in Quebec City. I mean, I'm sure of it. And but the thing is, what a lot of people don't realize is that they don't give out expansion teams and franchises or relocate unless you have a building. That's why Winnipeg has a team right now. That's pretty well the only reason why Winnipeg has a team right now, was because they had a building that the Atlanta Thrashers could move into, and it was a very seamless thing, and they were able to do it very quickly. So you've got to have the building. So, you know, if you want to get an expansion franchise, you've got to prove to the NHL that you're willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a building. So that's where we're at, and I assume that that this thing is going to get done in some form or another at some point in the next couple of years. And I would expect not long after that the NHL will see the potential and they'll put a team there.
But Ken, don't you see one speed bump to this entire plan? I know that Winnipeg wouldn't have you know, been handed the Atlanta Thrashers were it not for the MTS Center. We all understand that. You need the building, or else you're going to get a team.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you very well know, living in the area, there is a building called Cops Coliseum, which was built for that very purpose, which to me still remains probably the most depressing arena in all of North America, because it represents that hope to get the NHL team. It was a team that never came. It was close. You know, it probably should have happened when, you know, Ottawa and Tampa got their expansion teams, but it didn't.
Is that a
potential speed bump? Or is this a potential red flag to those city councilors in Markham that, hey, you know what? Sure, it worked in Winnipeg because they had a building, but let's not forget what happened in Hamilton.
No question about it. And there's so many layers to this. I mean, the guys who are building it, Graham Rustin, who used to be the chairman of Bauer, and he's backed by a guy by the name of Rudy Brady, who's a billionaire developer in Toronto, one of the biggest and richest developers in the country. They claim that the building can still be self-sufficient without an anchor tenant in it. But make no mistake. They're not building this building because they want to hold 130 or 140 concerts a year. Not a chance. They are building this building because they want an NHL team, and they think they can get one. But the problem is that the politicians in Markham are saying, you know, wait a second, let's get the team first, then we'll build the building. And that's where the whole dispute is right now. What they don't realize is that the NHL is saying, no. See how it works is, you build the building first, then we'll come. But what they want is the NHL to say, okay, we'll give you a franchise. Then, giddy up, let's go. The only problem with comparing it to Cops is that Hamilton would adversely affect the Buffalo Sabres. And I think that's always been the biggest problem. It's not the Leafs. It's the Sabres, I think, that they would be worried about infringing on their territory. So, this wouldn't be a problem. I mean, it would be infringing on the Leafs territory, but I think that would definitely be something that could be worked out.
Well, there you go. All right. The great Ken Campbell joining us here on Merrick versus Wyshynski. You got one more for Merrick?
Yeah, I do. I just want to, because it's a fascinating story, and I want to go back to Ken's book, Selling the Dream, How Hockey Parents and Their Kids Are Paying the Price for a National Obsession, an outstanding read. By the way, we got a tweet from someone asking Ken, where is this book available in the United States because he can't find it? Is it there yet?
I don't think it is, but he can order it online on Amazon. And I'm sure he or she would be able to get it that way.
Well, and the other thing I wanted to follow up with,
I'm really
glad you included this player in your book, because I can very well recall he's the next Gretzky. Tell us the story of Mitchell Davis.
How ridiculous is that? How irresponsible is it to call anybody the next Gretzky?
It happened.
Like, are you kidding me? You know, I mean, he broke Wayne Gretzky's quote unquote scoring record when he was 8 years old. And now he's the next Gretzky? Like, how many kids have we seen that have scored 100 goals when they were 7 years old and never were heard from again? And that's what happened with this kid. And I sat down and I talked to him. I sat in his basement in North Bay for about 3 hours and talked to him and his dad. And that was the worst thing that could have ever happened to him. His life changed so dramatically after that. You know, I mean, just the expectation level that was placed on that kid was immense, and the petty jealousies and the resentments and all those sorts of things, not worth it at all. I mean, to me, hey, look, there's a lot of people that are complicit in this. One of them is the kid's dad, because the kid's dad kept track of, you know, how many kids at 8 years old do their dads keep track of how many goals they're scoring and whether or not they're breaking Wayne Gretzky's scoring record when he was 8 years old. I know, I don't think that that's showing a whole lot of perspective, but, you know, it just spiraled out of control. I mean, it started as a little report on the North Bay TV station that this kid had scored, the, you know, 10 goals that day and had broken Wayne Gretzky's scoring record. And then the father told me the next thing he knows, Adrian Arsenault from the National and somebody from CTV News are having a yelling match in their driveway over who's going to get to talk to the kid first. You know, wow. it was just incredible. Like Jay Leno and all this other stuff, they all called to try and get him on the show, and it just spiraled out of control. And this was like in 2000 or 2001. Can you imagine if that happened now? You know, with social media and Twitter and everything, it would have gone viral in seconds. You know, and this was way before all of that. So, you know, that's a cautionary tale. To me, Pierre Dupuis, a kid from Sudbury who was the best 12-year-old in Canada and was supposed to be the next Guy Lafleur or Gretzky or Bobby Orr, those are all cautionary tales. You know, let's dial this down a bit. I mean, these kids are doing some special things, but my goodness. You know, I was talking to Alan McCauley last night. He's a scout for the LA Kings now, and he said that he was reading one time when he was in the league that in the 100 or whatever years that the NHL's been in existence, there have only been 5,000 players total play in the league. I mean, that to me is mind-boggling. Yeah. Like 5,000 guys total over all these years. I mean, I don't think people sometimes realize what it takes and how special you have to be in order to have even a career in the NHL. I mean, we crunched the numbers, and it's just ridiculous. Like it's one in 2,500 boys might play one game in the NHL.
So can I do a quick follow-up? Quick follow-up on that, Ken. Having said all of that,
yep.
Dude, have you seen the Sean Day kid in CompuWare play?
I haven't seen him. I have not seen him. I've heard about him. I talked to his dad.
Man.
I've interviewed the kid and his dad, and I understand he is very, very special. And he's going to try for the exemption, of course, exceptional player. What I like about what the CHL has done here is they set the bar really high for this designation. I mean, and you know, Connor McDavid is now he's kind of the guy that you have to measure yourself against. I don't know if this kid is as good as Connor McDavid because I haven't seen him play, but I know he's quite a special player. I've been told by scouts that the day he steps into the OHL, he'll be the best skater in that league. Like I guess the kid just skates there's no tomorrow. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, this kid's at an age where he's big enough and he's strong enough and he's fast enough, and he'll probably get that exemption, I would think. There's another kid out west too, Tyler. I can't remember his
Benson.
Last name, but he's
Tyler Benson.
Tyler Benson out in Edmonton. Yeah, he's another kid that apparently people are going absolutely gaga over.
Yeah, he's breaking all the Ty Ratty's records.
The day kid's grown up in Detroit, but he's got a really cool backstory. He was born, I think, in Belgium.
Yes.
He lived the first couple of years of his life in Singapore, and then they moved to Detroit. But the kid's got a Canadian passport, so he's going to play for Canada. He's never lived a day in Canada. Never lived day in Canada, and he wants to play for Canada's national team.
So, his parents are from dad's from Toronto, mom's from Burlington. Belgium. Dad works plastics. Had the kid. They moved to Singapore into Detroit, where dad's head office was. He's never lived a day in Canada. Holds Canadian citizenship. Never applied for a U.S. citizenship. So he's never lived a day in Canada, Kenny. But he's going to play for Team Canada and probably be drafted into the OHL.
I know.
It's a weird story.
It is.
All right, Ken, you're the best, sir. Anything you want to follow up with?
No, I'm just delighted that you guys would talk to me. I'm just so tickled.
Why would we talk to you?
Greg, you haven't even taken me on for anything today. Like, aren't we supposed to get in some kind of argument or something?
We usually do, but I think we're like-minded in so far as crazy hockey parents and crazy hockey people taking advantage of crazy hockey parents. And also, you agreed with me off the hop about the hit. So we have nothing to argue about today.
Ah, that's too bad. Well, let's try a little harder the next time, okay?
Yeah, you got it, man.
We'll do it. Thanks, Ken. Right. Great book,
thanks,
by the way.
Guys.
Great book.
Thanks,
great book.
Guys. I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Selling the Dream is the name of the book. Ken Campbell with Jim Parcells, how hockey parents and their kids are paying the price for a national obsession. You know, you touched on something really interesting there, Wish, when you talked about, you know, a lot of the, you know, the way that people always have their hands in hockey parents' pockets, whether it's programs, whether it's more ice time. See, I don't mind that. I don't mind that those things are available. I don't mind the idea of summer hockey or, you know, off-ice training or skills development. I have no problem with any of those programs. The one problem I do have with all of it is the fear-mongering that comes with it. There's one phrase that you're a parent, I'm a parent, that can strike fear into a parent when you hear it, and it's always attached to these programs. And you know what it is?
What's
don't
that?
Don't let your kid get left behind. And that's the pitch for almost all of them, right? You better come, you better have your kid on the ice 12 months a year. You don't want him or her to fall behind. It's the fear mongering that comes along with it. That's the main problem I have with it. Like, look, you know where I work at, Wish, here in Stouffville? It's a place called Body Smith International. Randy Smith is the head trainer. He's the guy that trained, Stamkos, trains Michael Delzato. So I work out with these types of guys. I work out with like OHL guys like all day long. And you should see the shape that these kids are in. Like over the Christmas break, it was full of OHL players because they're all on their break. And you wouldn't believe the level of dedication and fitness and how they talk about what they do and how I'm going to measure, you know, I got to get a certain amount of rest. I'm going to go back and this is my cardio day and this is this day and this is that day and here's what I'm eating. Like, and these kids are like 17 years old. Holy smokes, Swish. When I was 17 years old, I was like, well, do I smoke DeMaurier or Export A's? Like, that was my decision when I was that age. Now it's like, they're like measuring their protein and their carbohydrates. It is insane. But these programs are all available. So I understand the desire that parents have. What impresses me too now is it's not just, I find the parents that are pushing, because in a lot of ways, and a lot of hockey parents will work out of this gym as well. As much as some parents do push, a lot of parents don't. But there is like this insane drive that kids have now because they can see a path laid out in front of them and how they can get there. And there's constant improvement both on the ice and off the ice. And it's inspiring because you want to think where hockey is going to be in 5 or 10 years from now. Like, think about this for one second. You're listening at home, listening in your iPod, on treadmill, you're in your car. Think about hockey right now. It's pretty great, right? Like, hockey right now is fantastic. I felt this way about hockey when I was 12. And I felt this way about hockey when I was 7. Okay? Can you imagine, Wish, because it's continually grown and continually gotten better, and hockey right now is awesome. What's hockey going to be like in 10 years? Like, we think, oh, how much faster can they go? How much harder can they shoot? How much more creative? How much high skill can they exhibit? It's even going to get better, Wish. You think this is it? I thought 1987 was the best, man. It's got way better than 1987.
I mean, obviously, rocket skates. I mean, we know that for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
But beyond that, I really can't predict anything in particular. Hey, so PK Subban is back with Montreal, but how accepted is PK Subban in the Montreal locker room, Jeff Merrick?
Well, weird comments yesterday from a couple of Montreal blue liners, specifically Andre Markov and Josh Georges. We'll let you hear it for yourself. By the way, PK Subban did join his team today. No indication whether he'll play against the Ottawa Senators this evening. I doubt it. Probably a weekend return for PK is probably more on the cards, maybe Saturday against the Buffalo Sabres. But let's have a listen to both Andre Markov and Josh Georges commenting on the impending return. Mind you, this is yesterday, the impending return of PK Subban.
Actually, sorry. We're going to talk about tonight's game and tomorrow night game. Okay, I'd like to see the question about tonight game and tomorrow night game. Sorry, he's not in the room yet, so let's talk about that when he's going to be in the room.
We don't have to come in here and answer these questions anymore. I've never been through this. I've never played on a team where someone held out and wasn't here for the start of camp. We expect everyone that's in this room to buy in. We're going to expect PK to buy in, just like they expect me to buy in, like we expect Brian to buy in.
Okay, first of all, hold on. So did PK Subban have a contract and he refused to report? Because that's what a holdout is.
No, holdout.
So he didn't have a contract, so he didn't come. Yes! Like Josh Georges, come on, you're not a stupid man. This was not, well, I've never had a scenario where a player held out. It's not a holdout. He didn't have a contract, so he wasn't at camp. It was called business. That's what PK Subban is doing. But
the real issue is that these guys aren't idiots. These guys aren't idiots. They know that the chilly reception they're giving this kid through the media will be filtered throughout the media. And what's the use of it? Like, what's the use of acting like a little bitch about PK Subban coming back in your locker room? What's the use of it? A, if you have a problem with it, keep it in the room. And B, why?
Take it up with him. Take it up with PK Subban. Is it jealousy? Is it envy? Who knows? I don't know. I was surprised by Markov, who, you know, when PK Subban was leading the Montreal Canadiens, Andre Markov couldn't walk. Okay? Andre Markov couldn't stand up. So to say, oh, he's not in the room. We don't talk about him. We'll talk about game today, tomorrow. Don't talk. He's not in the room. We don't talk. Where were you when he was carrying this team? Oh, yeah, you're on crutches. Interesting enough, too, he has the same agent as PK Subban. I think he's a Donovan Green guy, too. And the Josh Georges one, man, that's one I have a hard time figuring out. First with the holdout comment, then, well, we expect them all to buy in. How about, like, we're happy to have him back. It's good, you know, our team's doing really well. We just won 4 games in a row, and with PK Subban, we're only going to become better. It's a great day for the Montreal Canadiens. Pretty simple, right? Not since, Wish, Sean Avery joined the Dallas Stars did we hear teammates talk about a player like this. Remember Modano and Turco?
Yep.
When Brett Hull brought in Sean Avery, and the first thing out of their mouth wasn't, well, we'd like to welcome him to the Dallas Stars. You know, it's a great organization. Sean's a great player, hardworking guy. I'm glad to have him aboard. No, it was like, right away, well, he's got to learn how to play hockey our way. We're not going to put up with any of those shenanigans. Like, right away, it was a scolding. Like, don't you get the sense that listening to Josh Georges, it was like a media scolding?
It really was.
By Josh Georges to VK Subban?
For what purpose? Because he was a restricted free agent who decided to actually hold out to see if he get the contract he wanted. Well, you know, just because Josh Georges jumped at a contract doesn't mean that everybody who doesn't jump at a contract is trying to undermine the team.
And it's business. Like, that's the business of hockey. Josh Georges has done business. He's done, you know, contracts through his agent for himself before. That is the business side of it. There's a hockey side and the business side. And Subban wasn't done his business side yet. It's really bizarre to me. Almost to the point where you wonder if, Wish, and I'm serious about this, that's the last contract PK Subban will sign with the Montreal Canadiens.
Potentially.
It wouldn't surprise me if the Montreal Canadiens, and listen, there's a very manageable number now, end up trading PK Subban.
Ooh. Go ahead.
As you say, if this causes a rift, much like, remember when there was Camp Kovalev and Camp Koivu in Montreal, and Bob Gainey said, all right, fine, we're getting rid of everybody after that 100-year anniversary? You hope not, but you wonder if the same thing could happen this time around.
We went a little long with Ken Campbell. We have a new department to debut on the show today, so we're going to forego the question of the day. Maybe we'll pick up some of those for tomorrow and get right to it. The new super special segment on the program, it's a mailbag segment. We call it Going Postal. Do you want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Not that deep.
We are nutting up for each other here.
Now's your chance to ask Merrick and Wyshynski anything, and we mean anything.
You got your thinking, Took?
Vegan cooking tips. Favorite Doctor Who characters. What's the best bar in Stouffville? Is there a bar in Stouffville? The meaning of life. Let's not get carried away with that.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter @JeffMerrick and @Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
So
So we put out the clarion call for submissions going postal last night. We received about 4 dozen, which is great. So we can't get to them all, but we'll get to some. And we're going to do this every Wednesday. It's a way for you guys to ask us questions that's not simply the issues of the day or the question of the day or even anything hockey-related. It's just an ask-us-anything kind of situation, Jeff Merrick.
Pretty much. It's the other way of just doing an Ask Me Anything show. Well, we talked about it last week, right? Why not do mailbag? So we're going to park this every Wednesday, right?
Yes. Wednesday.
Every Wednesday. PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. Anything. Could be hockey. Could be not hockey. We don't discriminate. Ask
away. Nate in Ohio, who's a Habs fan, has the first going postal questions for us. Greg and Jeff, going postal, it's no longer a Ted Kaczynski joke. Anyway, love the show. Glad you guys are doing this for us. I have 2 questions for you. One for both. What NHL uniform considered ugly in its time would you most like to see back on the ice? Now, I've got a very specific one that may or may not qualify for this answer, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Okay.
The St. Louis Blues trumpet jersey that never actually made it onto the ice because Mike Keenan strangled it in the crib. if you've never seen it, it's got mighty, mighty coronets emerging from the player's waist and bellowing forth little blue notes. And it was sort of like a crazy, I don't remember. It was like a sunburst or something behind them. It really kind of was garish, and maybe in comparison with the more traditional Blues jersey, not exactly that palatable. But a tweak here and a tweak there, and I think the trumpet jersey would be something I'd like to see as a third jersey, wear it maybe 6 times a year kind of thing for the St. Louis Blues.
Surprise, surprise. Mine would be from a defunct team. And you know what it is, Wish?
Yeah.
It is the California Golden Seals. I love that combination of that green and that yellow and that seal and that hockey stick.
Was that considered to be an ugly jersey in and of its time? I don't know what the reaction was to the Seals.
That would have been 1967, so I was -2. So I don't know whether it was considered garish. I know the white skates were considered garish. That's true, and I don't know that we want to see those back anytime soon. Although didn't Fedorov have the white Nike skates for a while there with the Detroit Red Wings?
I believe so. Nathan has a follow up for you. Nate in Ohio has a follow up for you. This one is for Jeff only. We know Wish has a love of the New York Jets that may contribute to an early death since it's Super Bowl week. Do you have a favorite CFL/NFL team, Jeff Merrick?
I don't really. I mean, because I'm not really much of a football guy. By default, I've always been a Toronto Argonauts fan. Hey, we won the Grey Cup.
Yay.
Yeah, I know. I was a big Conridge Holloway guy growing up as a little CFL fan. But I don't really have a CFL or an NFL team that I cheer for. Having said that, you know what I drink my daily cup of coffee in, Wish? Mainly because it was a high school gift from a friend's mom that I've always just liked the cup and liked the design on it. Every morning I drink a cup of coffee from my Detroit Lions coffee mug. It's true.
Wow.
Have I ever seen a Detroit Lions game live? Nope.
No.
Will I ever see a Detroit Lions game live? Probably not. But I drink a cup of coffee from my Detroit Lions coffee mug every day.
This is from Matt Vaughn from Saskatoon, but originally from Cole Harbor. Hey, Cole Harbor, huh?
Sydney and Nathan. I know.
Sirs, Wyshynski and Merrick, as a relatively new hockey fan, I was blown away by Canada at the 2010 Olympics. Wait, you're from Saskatoon and you're a relatively new hockey fan? Are you 3 years old? Like, what?
Or from
every
Cole Harbor.
Canadian...
Yeah.
I know, right? Jeez. Wow. I'm still catching on to some of the nuances of hockey talk. I get the game more or less, but some things still mystify me. Why, for instance, do some hockey commentators during the playoffs confidently proclaim that Team X will win in 7 games. How can anyone have any reason to think that it's anything more than a coin toss after Game 6? I get that they have something, they have to say something, or they might as well not be there, but it's been bugging me. Thanks for doing the mailbag thing, Matt. When I make a 7-game prediction, I just kind of see it as being one of the okay, when I make a 7-game prediction in the Puck Daddy prognostications for the playoffs, it's usually because I believe that the teams will split the first 4 games. That's usually my basis. It's not like I think someone's sprinting out three goose and the other team's roaring back to win 4 in a row. It's usually because I think that the two teams will hold serve on home ice, and then you go bing bang boom and you get 7 games out of the series. That's usually why I do it.
Now, I think the question, though, is couched within the framework of TV prognosticators. And I'll tell you exactly why that happens. Because, first of all, I believe when you say game 7, you're pretty much saying, I don't know when it's jump ball. But when you look at TV guys, or if you look at hockey people that are, quote-unquote, trying to get back into the game, what they never want to do is offend someone. They never want to offend a team, never want to offend a player, never want to offend an executive, or the worst... an owner or Gary Bettman. So if you look, most times when you see someone who is trying to get back into the game and they ask him for a prediction on a series, he will always say a couple of things. One, they're both well coached. They're both well run organizations. I have a lot of respect for both. It's going to be a close series and it's probably going to go 7. That way you're not insulting anyone by saying your team, buddy, is going to get blown out. I think that's why a lot of people on TV, guys are trying to get back in, will say, I think it's going to go 7 games. There was one year, oh man, I can't remember who the coach was. It was an ex-NHL coach who was doing picks in the Toronto Sun with Mike Zeisberger. And in the opening round, which it was hilarious. Every series, going 7 games. Every single series was going 7 games. I'm like, oh, I know you want to get back in the league, bud, but please, please spare me. It's pretty obvious.
That's funny. That's really funny. This is from Spatula Pete. Spatula Pete writes, during the lockout, Merrick pointed out that Bettman has made the players very, very rich, and it made me wonder how the changes for the last 20 years or so have affected the fans. So instead of that game where you take a player from the 1950s, like Rocket Richard, and drop him into a game today and he gets trounced, or take a fourth liner from today and drop him into the 1950s and he dominates, what if you took a fan from the 1950s and dropped him or her into a game today? Would that fan still like the game? And what about the reverse? Now, I can't speak to the game-going traditions of the 1950s as far as, like, if you or I were dropped back there, what we'd think. I have a feeling, knowing what I like out of a game, I'd be down for the fighting. I would not be down for the crowd dynamics. For example, I don't think that there was an equivalent of a Flyer suck chant in 1950. There was probably harsh whistling, and I'm not down with that. If you took 1950s fan and placed them in today's National Hockey League, one, obviously overwhelmed because they've never seen an LED screen before. They would probably think there's too much music and it's too loud. And beyond that, I don't know. I have a feeling that they'd find it to be – well, you know, here's the thing. Back in the 1950s, they all thought that every city was going to be in the clouds and we all have flying cars and our own jetpacks. So from a futurist standpoint, I imagine going to a game would be a kick because there's so much cool shit going on in these games that didn't exist in the 1950s. From a hockey playing experience, though, I'm not sure. Maybe they'd be dazzled by the speed of the game.
I think the speed is the big one. I think from a live event point of view, I think all the things you mentioned are bang on. It's too loud. It's too bright. Let's not forget, once upon a time in hockey, the lights were only on the rink and it was dark elsewhere. Almost like you're going to a boxing match or you're going to a wrestling match or something like that. So A, it's too bright. A, it's too loud. Two, they'll pick up on the speed. You know what I think they would, if you took a hockey fan from the 50s and put him in 2013, I think the area where he or she would look at the game and say, this is bizarre, what's going on here, is if you watch it on television. Because something as simple as a replay, what the F is a replay? Because TV's still in its infancy. Wait a minute, you can back up television and we can watch that again? And then you could do, what's a spot shadow? You could do a spot shadow? What's happening on this magic box of yours? So I think that's more about the technology more than anything else. I think live event, you're bang on. I think the one area where I think a 50s fan will look at 2013 and say, whoa, this is scrambling my brain here, is when you watch it on television. And I think if you're a fan now and you go back in the 50s, I think everyone in the crowd looks at you and go, Sir, ma'am, you should be wearing either a suit or a dress. Mm-hmm. That is how that's the proper attire for going to a hockey match.
Yeah. And also the people from the 1950s would be bamboozled by the presence of minorities in the crowd. They wouldn't know what to do with it. Oh, my goodness. Why is this person here? Michael Leone writes in, I don't recall you guys ever talking about Peter Forsberg, my favorite player. Were you fans?
Oh, yeah.
What did you like, dislike about his game? Your show makes me happy every day, Michael. I was a fan. I mean, I was a big fan. And I think he's in the Pat LaFontaine class of great what-ifs. If it weren't for injuries, if it weren't for losing significant time, and also if it weren't for playing in the era that he played in, what would Peter Forsberg have been at the end of his career, points-wise, legacy-wise?
He was my favorite Avalanche.
Oh, really? More than Sakic?
All of them. Yep, more than Sakic. Peter Forsberg was. And I'll tell you why. Because I grew up in Toronto watching a couple of Swedish hockey players by the name of Börje Salming and Inge Hammarström get assaulted every game on the ice. You want to go look at an assault? Go to YouTube and type in Mel Bridgman on Börje Salming. It's a brutal beating. And we always heard the moniker, yo, Chicken Swede. Harold Ballard, the owner of the Maple Leafs, would say of, you know, his own player, Inge Hammarström, he could go into the corner with a dozen eggs in his pocket and come out without one of them broken. Right? Soft players, chickens. We all heard the things and the stereotypes about Swedes. What I loved about Peter Forsberg is he married a high work ethic and a high quality of play with also being a prick and being tough. I love the fact that in his era, a Swede was the best power forward in the game. That's what I loved about Peter Forsberg. That's one of the reasons why I think he was my favorite Av of all time. I got nothing but great things to say. And you know what else I liked about Peter Forsberg? A lot of people will always say, you know, you'll leave the stage while they're still clapping. Go out on top. I loved all the comebacks. I loved the guy that said, I don't think I'm done yet. Like, he was the guy who literally said, even though my body is saying quit, there's still a part of me that says, I can keep going. I'm going to keep trying the comeback. Now, you can blame the Colorado Avalanche for acquiescing too many times and saying, fine, we're going to give you another shot here. I get that. But he still had the heart and the drive that even though his body was breaking down, he did not want to quit. And Wish, isn't that something we always say we admire about hockey players? He embodied it 100%. That's why I love Peter Forsberg.
And I also love the fact that he was one of the first players that I can remember as a fan where his legacy preceded him in the National Hockey League based on what he did as an international player. Like now, now every guy who comes over here has YouTube highlights, be it Michael Granlund, be it Linus Omark, whoever, you know, even a guy like Philip Forsberg, the other Forsberg, when he comes to the Washington Capitals, we'll have known what he did in World Junior and all this other stuff. But for me as an American fan, I knew Peter Forsberg before he got here. It reminded me of the old in the old days in wrestling when there was a guy from another territory that you were aware of because he used to read the dirt rags and the gossip sheets.
Well, the Bill Apter magazines, like Pro Wrestling Illustrated.
You knew the name, but you were really, really excited when you finally got a chance to see him in the WWF. And it was the same thing with Forsberg. Like, you knew the name, you knew the legacy, you knew what he did on the Olympic level and all that other stuff, and now you got a chance to see him in the league, and it was very exciting.
Dude, he's on a stamp. Hirsch. He's on a stamp. Like, even though it is the Kent Nielsen move, first done by Kent Nielsen on John Van Beesbrouck at the World Championships, when you look at that move, the player swings one way, drags his stick out the other way, and just taps it in the net, that's still called the Peter Forsberg move. You see it all the time.
Last one in Going Postal this week, and I think it's been a very successful segment. We'll definitely do this again next week.
Should do more of them. Should do more questions.
You don't want to ruin a good thing, man. You know, it's like having a shootout every night. This comes from Kelly Toomey. By the way, thanks to Kelly for giving me a pronunciation. Giving your old pal Wisha a little pronunciation. A little helperoo with the last name.
Help him out.
Kelly Toomey writes in, I'm not usually able to keep up with the show live or on Twitter, so I thought I'd take this chance to get my question in. By means of coping with the lockout, I was re-listening to every old MVSW when there wasn't a new one that day. Oh, Merrick's story retelling, charming as it is, becomes funnier when he's telling the same story on the November shows.
I'm getting old.
In March. But
I'm just, you know what I'm doing? Rehearsing being a senior citizen. That's what I'm convinced I'm doing. I'm rehearsing being a senior.
And you've got the routine down, sir. You are ready for Carnegie Hall.
Thanks,
but The one story he never finished telling, and hopefully you remember this story, Old Man Merrick, was the Jonathan Toews Tri-City American story. He teased it well over a year ago, but enough is enough.
Oh, really?
Thanks and keep up the great work. What is the Jonathan Toews Tri-City American story? Do you remember this?
Did I ever tell this story on the podcast?
Now, Kelly's listened to the entire back catalog like five times. So
okay.
I'm assuming that if you told it, we would remember.
Okay, so the backstory on this one is Jonathan Toews growing up, outstanding hockey player, and was scheduled to go first overall in the Bantam draft in the Western Hockey League. And the Tri-City Americans held that pick. And the Tri-City Americans, before they made the selection, talking to Camp Toews, said, if we draft Jonathan, will he go to Tri-City? Because there was also, you know, North Dakota with other universities as well. But North Dakota was really interested in Jonathan Toews for the obvious reasons. WCHA, got to get him in here. The Toews camp, from what I'm told, assured the Tri-City Americans that if he is drafted, he will play in the Western Hockey League. Boom. Great. They draft Jonathan Toews. Part of the other part of the backstory is the Tri-City Americans were owned by Olaf Kolzig of the Washington Capitals. Keep that in your hip pocket. So it comes down to make the decision. They've already drafted Jonathan Toews. Jonathan Toews decides not to play for Tri-City. Instead, he goes to the University of North Dakota, where he puts up like 350 points and a couple of fighting Sioux,
and also had a lot of beer bongs too from the photos I've seen.
So who does this enrage? The Tri-City Americans, obviously, and by extension, their owner, who just wasted a first overall pick in the Bantam draft. Oof. And that's Olaf Kolzig. So we fast forward then, Wish, to the 2006 NHL entry draft, the Eric Johnson draft, if you will. St. Louis proud to select Eric Johnson, goes first to St. Louis. Pittsburgh, then, at second overall, they select, from the Peterborough Petes of the OHL, Jordan Staal. The next two on the board are the Chicago Blackhawks and the Washington Capitals. This is the draft in Vancouver. And Olaf Kolzig is there, along with Alexander Ovechkin and the rest of the Washington Capitals, to make their pick. And so it came down to Chicago. And the speculation was always Chicago was going to go with the kid from the University of Minnesota. They were going to draft Phil Kessel. They wanted the American speedster, the guy that can score the goals, the Sidney Crosby of the USA as he was being described growing up. So this was the tension on the draft floor. If Chicago had drafted Phil Kessel or maybe Nicholas Backstrom, that would leave the Washington Capitals. And there's no way that Jonathan Toews was going to go lower than fourth. But the question was, would George McPhee put Jonathan Toews in the same dressing room as Olaf Kolzig after Jonathan Toews said no and screwed him out of the first overall pick in the Bantam draft? Would George McPhee put Toews in there and then have Olaf Kolzig on stage with Alexander Ovechkin to welcome him to Washington with a sweater and a hat? It was one of the most tense moments from my experience at the NHL draft. What is going to happen? Will Chicago pass on Toews and take Kessel? And Chicago ruined it. They took Jonathan Toews. Washington took Nicholas Backstrom. Boston grabbed Phil Kessel. Columbus took, who did they take? Derek Brassard. And then away we go for the rest of the draft. So that's the Jonathan Toews story. He was that close to having one of the most uncomfortable moments of his career on the same team and in the same room as Olaf Kolzig. Yeah. So there's the Jonathan Toews story with Tri-City and the Washington Capitals.
And postscript, if you don't remember, the Capitals then won five consecutive Stanley Cups. It's pretty impressive.
Four years later, Chicago won the cup.
Oh, really? Because I remember the. Yeah, no, are you sure? Because I remember the Capitals. No, they didn't get to the final that year. All right. Well, anyways. This has been Going Postal. We'll do it again every week. And please, if you have any of the Going Postal questions and queries for myself and Jeff Merrick, puckdaddyblog@yahoo.com. Put postal in the subject line, and we will mash it over.
As you know, I'm not shy about telling stories over and over again. So if it's a story you've already heard, but just want Uncle Jeffy to tell it again, Grandpa here won't mind.
I've long considered putting a rule in place on the podcast where we don't stop Merrick. Like when Elena was the producer, Elena would try to stop Merrick from doing the same story over and over again, by the way.
Josh just lets me right. Josh is something you guys
Josh,
right
Josh gives him free reign.
Right through the stop sign.
Do whatever you want.
The,
totally
the new rule, I think, might be that it will require Merrick to do the story in a different accent, maybe next time, potentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what we'll do.
If I start to tell a story, it's been repeated, then just tell me and I'll do it in another accent.
Anyways,
I'll just make up other facts with it.
Oh, that's a good plan as well.
Yeah, thanks.
I am Greg Wyshynski, Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet tonight on Hockey Central at 11, working today with, Neil Smith is back, and Brad May as well. That's your crew for Hockey Central tonight.
And don't forget tonight, the Chicago Blackhawks going for win number 7 on the season against no losses, either in regulation or overtime, facing the Minnesota Wild tonight. It's the NBC game. Last night, the San Jose Sharks, thanks to the gaping five hole of Jonas Hiller, survived to be undefeated another day. So Chicago now trying to go to 7-0. San Jose now 6-0 on the season. And we got, anytime you're this deep into the season and you can honestly say you've got two teams with a shot at going perfect. Well, it's been a good season then, hasn't it?
Montreal and Ottawa. Montreal has won 4 games in a row. Ottawa did their best last night, Wish, at handing the Washington Capitals their 2nd win in a row. But Washington fumbled that ball horribly. Montreal and Ottawa tonight. Edmonton and Phoenix. By the way, all eyes on Phoenix. When, Wish? Tomorrow, when Greg Jamieson has his deadline to close the deal and buy the Phoenix Coyotes. Or else that lease is gone, and the $320 million over 20 years, that little perk goes bye bye. Also, Colorado and Vancouver. Colorado is 0-2 to kick off this road trip, and no indication that they will win another game for the remainder of the season.
Landeskog out again, probably. Luongo between the pipes.
Yes.
2nd straight start for the guy who simply must be traded because he's throwing the entire team into chaos. Please. Two-headed monster, goaltending, 48-game season. Be smart. Be stupid, Gillis. Keep this thing going, all right? Especially with Eddie Lack laid up for the next 5 years with an injury, evidently.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, Jake Gardner got assigned to the Marlies, by the way. I just got the note now. Jake Gardner back to the Marlies.
By the way, one last note about the Southeast Division currently right now. The Tampa Bay Lightning 5-1, 10 points on the season, plus 14 goal differential. The Florida Panthers 1-5, minus 14 goal differential. Oh, so it's as if they are the yin and yang of Floridian hockey, the Lightning and the Panthers.
Can I ask you a quick little question before we sign off?
Sure.
Who's in more trouble? Joe Sacco, Kevin Dineen, or Dan Bylsma?
You're gonna have to give me some time to think about the Bylsma.
There are a lot of people within hockey starting to whisper, has the Bylsma routine worn off in Pittsburgh? It's out there.
Stakes are high, man. Coming off that loss last year in the playoffs.
Yep.
I still think it's a personnel issue. I still think that firing Dan Bylsma is not gonna get Sidney Crosby a winger.
I know, but you lose that way to the Islanders at home last night. I don't know that Ray Shiro has. I don't know that. Well, I think he owes it to the coach to make a trade. But if Sydney, and there's no indication that Sydney's squawking about either a trade or a coach, but you need to do pretty much whatever it takes to keep that guy happy and get this team winning again.
Less interested in who becomes the next coach of the Pittsburgh Penguins than I am very interested in knowing what the Pittsburgh Penguins will ante up for Phil Kessel.
It would have to be one of those defensemen, like one of the young guys, like Derek Pouliot or Olli Mäta, Scott Harrington, one of those guys. But even that's not enough. I'm telling you, man, you know what the trade is, bro. Sam Gagner. That's the trade. The more I think about it, the more I'm frickin' sold. That's the guy. That's the guy for Pittsburgh. Sam Gagner in Edmonton.
Hey, first time, long time. How about we give Ben Lovejoy a first-round pick and, I don't know, somebody from the Baby Penguins for Aginla? I'll hang up and listen.
Here's what you need to give Ben Lovejoy. Give Ben Lovejoy a hug. to your planner leader. That's what Ben Lovejoy needs.
That's right.
That man a hug.
If his name was Ben Hate Despair, then you'd hit him from behind.
Oh,
but,
but
it's Lovejoy, so you give him a hug.
Yeah,
of course.
Lovejoy, come on, man.
All right, everybody, we'll see you tomorrow. And by the way, I don't mean to besmirch the good name of Ben Hate Despair, wherever you are.
Yeah, he's good.
I assume you're listening to the show, if that is your name. Yeah. Oh, truculent. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye.